Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show where we explore the people, the stories, and the events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. And today is the first of a series of Local Talk shows I plan to do on Fridays, featuring water issues in Iowa. At this time of year, most people turn to water to cool off. But in Iowa, water issues are heating up as an August deadline approaches for a Clean Water Act rule, statewide candidates spout off, and waterworks engineers in Des Moines keep a nervous eye on nitrate levels to determine whether the world's largest nitrate removal system will need to kick into gear again. We'll cover all of those issues in this show and talk with David Osterberg, a public policy researcher who just yesterday released a paper on Iowa's nutrient reduction strategy. With me today for the whole hour is Evan Berger of Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, a grassroots citizen advocacy group that has been organizing citizen voices around the issue of water quality for decades. In the past month, they've kicked into high gear and are recruiting Iowans to pledge their support to clean water. More on that campaign in a bit. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Greta. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Iowa CCI has a lot of issues on its plate. You deal with worker rights, immigrant rights, landowner rights. Is water quality a hot issue for the citizens of Iowa?
It definitely is, Greta. You know, I work all across the state, and one unique thing about this issue that I've found is that it really does unite all Iowans. You know, the one thing that everyone has in common is that we all have to drink water. So, one thing that's really special about it is it brings urban and rural people together, people from all across the state, all walks of life.
Yeah, in fact, when I was visited by Herman Kernbach, our Democratic candidate for senator in this area, he acknowledged that water quality was the thing that he kept hearing on the campaign trail as he went from door to door. And he did say that he planned to bring that message back to Democratic leadership.
Well, yeah, that's great to hear. One thing that CCI does is we're always pushing for better laws when it comes to water quality. And a lot of the regulation enforcement is tied to the executive branch, so our governor, which in the past has meant that when we have a Democratic governor, we have, pretty bad enforcement of the Clean Water Act. And then when we have a Republican governor, it really goes down the drain. It's really awful. regulatory regimes keep changing. And, I think that's part of what people don't like about regulation is when there's this, it changes every 4 years when someone comes into office. It'd be good if we just, had a good set of laws that we stuck to.
Well, can you give me an example of the regulatory regime changing?
Yeah, so I think one of the best examples of how it changes with the governorship is the Environmental Protection Commission. This is kind of the citizen oversight board of the DNR. It's a nine-member board, and the members are appointed by the governor at the time, as these staggered terms, and the governor gets to appoint new people. So, under Governor Culver and under Governor Vilsack, we had some, environmentalists, and in fact, there was just a people might have heard the name Susan Heathcote in the news recently. She was an EPC commissioner. But under Governor Branstad, the people he's chosen to appoint to this commission have been people actually who directly benefit from, the kind of agricultural practices that are impairing Iowa's waterways. So people who run hog confinements, people like Brent Rastetter who build hog confinements.
My neighbor Nancy Kauser is on the commission.
Yes,
she's got a huge cattle lot.
Yeah.
And so, well, I understand how, for instance, the funding of the Iowa DNR affects regulation because we don't have enough people inspecting out in the field. So, a lot of polluters are just getting by. Mm-hmm. But how does EPC, the Environmental Protection Commission that you talked about, how does that affect, day-to-day water issues?
Sure. So, the EPC is always important because they provide kind of the general direction for the DNR as a whole. And also they're kind of the buck kind of stops with them for the DNR. So, you can appeal DNR decisions to the EPC. But right now, at this moment, they're particularly important because they are the body that does rulemaking for the entire DNR. So if the DNR wants to implement a new administrative rule, that, they have a rulemaking process where the EPC has to take a vote on it, and then they run it by legislators as well, but the EPC is kind of the decision-making body there. And like I said, that's really crucial right now because there's a rule in front of them which really has the chance to change how Iowa implements the Clean Water Act. So just a little bit of history on this rule. Yeah.
This is a long story.
Sure. So, it's a long story, and it starts all the way back in, I guess, 1972, if we want to start really at the beginning, which is when the Clean Water Act was passed. Now, as many people probably know, this is a piece of federal legislation, and it's been wildly successful.
Yeah, that was back when the Cuyahoga River in my home state of Ohio caught on fire several times from industrial waste.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, we don't have things like that happen in America as often anymore. You know, the Clean Water Act really, you know, the system of permitting and inspections that it put into place really addressed industrial pollution very, very well. You know, this idea where there's like a pipe running out of a factory and dumping chemicals into a river, you don't really see that anymore, or at least it's heavily regulated.
And then did the EPA come about at around that time
That's
as well?
Right. That's exactly right. So
to enforce that.
Yeah. So, like I said, it did a great job with industrial or factory pollution. But what it kind of struggled with was the agricultural side of things, at least in some states, for example, Iowa. So even though, you know, we have the most hogs of any state in the country, and, you know, they're producing almost 10 billion gallons of manure a year, which is then applied to fields, the DNR has maintained this legal fiction that Iowa is a zero discharge state. They say out of those 10 billion gallons of manure, not a single drop is reaching our water. So, which is clearly not true, of course. So, you know, in 2007, Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, the group that I work with, another group called the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club, and then also a group called the Environmental Integrity Project. Those three groups kind of came together, and we said, look, the state of Iowa is clearly not enforcing the Clean Water Act for factory farms. And, you know, there is a legal process to go to the EPA and say, look, the state's not doing its job. You have to come in and take over for them, take over enforcement of the entire Clean Water Act, because they clearly can't handle it themselves. So that process is called, filing a de-delegation petition, kind of a technical term.
So and that happened when?
Yeah, so we filed one of these petitions in 2007, this coalition of three groups led by Iowa CCI. This really came about because of our long history organizing around factory farms. People just, this zero discharge mentality just blows people's minds, you know. Clearly, there's some pollution. When you look at the number of factory farms in Iowa and the impairment of our waterways, you know, they're increasing in tandem, right? As more get built, there's more nitrates, which is, you know, a chemical found in manure, where there's more E. coli in our rivers. You know, something has to be happening there. And like I said, in 2007, we filed this de-delegation petition, kind of technical term, and then, you know, the EPA said, okay, thank you very much, and they filed it away on a shelf, right, and kind of just sat on it for a couple of years. So we were very patient. We gave them some time to look it over, and then a couple of years later, around 2010, into 2011, we said, look, we've given you, 3 years now. You're not doing anything. Clearly, this is an unreasonable delay, and so we're going to file suit if you don't start doing something. That's what CCI and other groups said to EPA. So at that point, you know, we started to see some action. You know, the threat of a lawsuit actually kicked them into high gear. So the EPA finally came into Iowa, came into the kind of the DNR field offices, and did a very, very thorough examination of the DNR records, and kind of looked at DNR protocols, looked at kind of the rules that govern this process. And then in 2012, the summer of 2012, they issued a report which essentially confirmed everything that, you know, we had been saying at the beginning. You know, that was a great, great moment. So then the next step was EPA and DNR had to come together and figure out a work plan for how they were going to address these problems. So after a year of negotiation, they finally agreed on this work plan in 2013, and so that brings us kind of to today, because one of the major parts of this work plan was the DNR agreed that they would implement this rulemaking for finally issuing Clean Water Act permits.
Permits?
Yes, to hog factory farms.
So acknowledging that they're actually point sources and not just
Exactly.
Non-point agricultural good stuff.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. And that's why you're collecting pledge cards right now from citizens of Iowa.
That's exactly right. So the EPC is going to be voting on this rule in August 19th. And, you know, unfortunately, it's a pretty weak rule. They're kind of trying to do the absolute minimum with this rule. So, you know, CCI members and other concerned citizens are saying, look, that's not good enough. You need to strengthen this rule. So we're circulating these pledge cards to kind of show the EPC that thousands and thousands of Iowans are paying attention to this issue and that they need to do the right thing. So if it's okay, I'll just read the kind of the language. It's a very simple pledge. All it says is, you know, I pledge to fight for Iowa's right to clean water and put people before politics, profits, and polluters. You know, we think it's a pretty common sense thing. You know, everyone, I mean, I think Iowa has a right to clean water. You know, I think that people should come before polluters and profits and politics. So, very common sense. And, you know, it's just a way to show the EPC and the DNR and, you know, perhaps, you know, down the road candidates and legislators that there is a kind of block of Iowans who care deeply about clean water and are paying attention to this issue.
And so you collect some of our data, like email addresses.
Sure.
What are you going to do with that data? That's what people always want to know.
Yeah, no, that's totally fine. And it's a very legitimate question. The, you know, and so, you know, kind of our ultimate goal is we want to be able to communicate with people who care about this issue. It's, you know, it's all well and good to say, you know, circulate a petition and you get 500 or 600 names or, you know, in this case, 10,000 names is what we're aiming for. And then, you know, you deliver it and that's the end of it. But what we really want to do is to develop, like I said, this block of Iowans, of voters who are engaged in this issue. And then we're, of course, so we want to continue to communicate with you if you sign this pledge card. And we want to let you know about ways you can take action. We want to let you know about updates in this campaign. So that's why we ask for email addresses and you know, that sort of thing.
And I have to say, I've received some ICCI communications.
Sure.
And I think they're really good, well-written, to the point.
Thank you.
You're not just wasting our time.
I appreciate that's good to hear. Good to hear.
But I just have a question. You know, does the EPA have to go after other states to enforce the Clean Water Act, or is this just an Iowa thing?
Well, you know, EPA is not, or you know, other states aren't perfect, but they're a heck of a lot better than Iowa is, especially when it comes to this agricultural kind of stuff. You know, from what we see, you know, what I see personally up at the state house, it's kind of like legislators and politicians have this mentality that the Farm Bureau is just going to, you know, you can't do anything to cross the Farm Bureau or these big industrial ag groups. And so that's what's brought us to 630 impaired waterways. You know, that's over 55% of all the waterways in Iowa. Over half of the waterways in the state are impaired. So other states are having problems, but Iowa really is kind of ground zero of this debate and of this discussion.
Well, what you're saying kind of echoes what I heard when I talked to Bill Stowe yesterday at the Des Moines Waterworks.
You know, he's in a really difficult position, and he's been willing to speak out about it because he has to deal with what's coming down the river, but then he has mandatory standards to meet for drinking water. He has to produce safe drinking water. And he's, like I said, he's really spoken out about this issue. Great ally.
I'm on the line with Bill Stowe. He's the director of the Des Moines Public Works. He's the man responsible for taking the water from the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers and turning it into drinkable water for the people of Des Moines. Bill, last year you made news because you installed the world's largest municipal nitrate removal system. Is that correct?
Actually, we've had it for about 20 years, Greta, but last year we certainly overworked it, let's put it that way. The units themselves have been on site here in Des Moines for more than a couple decades, and we were forced to construct them in the 90s because at that time we failed to reach the safe drinking water standards for nitrate removal, and it was really a situation where we hadn't run them back into about 2008 or 2009. So it's something that we've had for a significant period of time. We'd mothballed it, hoping we wouldn't have to use them again, but last year they were regularly and expensively used. So the running of the units themselves are pretty expensive because of labor and electricity and chemicals associated with it. It's about a $10,000 a day expense to our ratepayers when we run them. We ran them for about 80 days last year in the months of May, June, and July, so about $800,000 of extra costs, $900 in extra costs associated with running those units because we had so much nitrate concentration in the waters of both rivers that to meet safe drinking water standards.
And did you get that machine out again this year? We've had some heavy rains.
We've had some heavy rains, and even as we speak today, we have high nitrate concentrations in both the Des Moines and Raccoon rivers. But the difference, Greta, this year versus last year is realistically that we just don't have that much customer demand. It's been cool and wet enough this summer that our need to produce at really high levels, which requires these units, just hasn't been there. We still see, unfortunately, unacceptably high levels of nitrates in both the Des Moines and Raccoon rivers, but our demand is low enough that we're able to denitrify through storage and some other techniques we have other than using the denitrification units themselves. So they're ready to run if we, unfortunately, were to see high nitrate concentrations continue, followed by high demand, which is certainly something, as we see the forecast, could happen. But we're hoping not to run them because they are expensive.
Okay, you mentioned high nitrate levels. Does the Des Moines Water Works have historical figures on nitrate levels in the rivers that it treats?
We do. Yeah, we do. We've been in this business really since just after the Civil War. Certainly the sophistication of how you test and what you test has increased exponentially for the last few decades. But we have historic trend information that goes back to the Depression, that is the 30s, for the Raccoon River, and really since the Clean Water Act in the early 70s for the Des Moines River. And both of them indicate trends that continue to increase in nitrate concentrations in Iowa. We hear a lot of talk, particularly by those who want us to believe that we're environmentally improving in this state. We have a lot of data that refutes the idea that whatever we're doing out in the ag community, the non-point source, unregulated part of our state, is somehow improving water quality. We see historic degradation of the Des Moines and Raccoon rivers that continues to today.
And bacteria is also an issue.
Absolutely. Bacteria and ammonia are issues that we have significant problems with and really view a combined animal feeding operations as being a major contributor. We see ammonia levels very high in the spring, in particular when runoff from fields, particularly those that have used manure as a fertilizer, create significant problems for us. The ammonia and the bacteria associated with that have us using a lot of chlorine as a disinfectant. Chlorine in and of itself can be a carcinogen, a cancer-causing agent, particularly when it's out in a distribution system, out in the piping system, and in areas that are fairly remote from our plants, and the piping systems don't flush those chlorine elements through on a regular basis. They create health risks for our customers also. So when we kind of step back and think about what we're seeing and why we're seeing, it's very clear that agricultural chemical pollution, particularly from fertilizers used on fields on the chemical side, create nitrate problems from us, and certainly from animal feeding operations and runoff from livestock manure in particular creates ammonia and bacterial concerns for us.
There are a few different proposals out there about how we can improve the situation. You've been out kind of on the stump a bit talking about this problem on behalf of your customers. Is there any particular solution that you advocate?
Long and short of what I advocate for on behalf of Des Moines Water Works customers really is regulation on the non-point or agricultural side of runoff coming down the waters of the state of Iowa. We spend a lot of time, a lot of money regulating cities, small towns, stormwater systems, industrial providers, but the data shows very clearly out of Iowa State, Department of Natural Resources and the Iowa Department of Agricultural and Land Stewardship in something called the Nutrient Reduction Strategy, that the pollution levels that we're seeing in our waters is 90% agriculture, 10% non-ag, which includes urban, suburban, wastewater plants, industrial providers. All the regulation is on the 10% side, very little regulation on the 90% side, and obviously that leads to the perverse results we still see, and that's increasing levels of pollutants in our water. So our concern is, forget about this idea of voluntary conservation on the ag side really leading to improvements in water quality. Hasn't happened, and it won't happen. We need to look very seriously about how we're going to protect the waters of the state, which are the commonwealth of all of us. Many of us take our water from surface water, from rivers and lakes, not from wells, which is groundwater, but from surface waters. And those waters in this state are heavily polluted by agricultural users.
Are there any models in other states of such regulation of non-point sources?
Absolutely. Often our surrounding states, particularly the North, Wisconsin and Minnesota, tie federal and state funding to the use of conservation practices. That is, cost sharing in agriculture or payments to farmers is directly dependent upon specific adoption of conservation practices. In our view, that is absolutely the right path. You and I and your listeners as federal taxpayers paid billions of dollars in the farm bill as direct payments to farmers, but yet require no tie back to protecting our water quality as part of that direct payment process. So certainly linking those up, as some states have, particularly the states of Minnesota and Wisconsin to our north and northeast, is going to be pretty important to our future as Iowans. We're very aware of the importance, historic importance of agriculture to Iowa, but realistically, agriculture is very important to a number of other states who have viewed the balance between environmental issues and agricultural issues far more progressively than Iowa has. Wisconsin and Minnesota are great examples of that. Wisconsin does a number of things to tie specific aid eligibility, that is government aid eligibility, to specific demonstration of conservation practice.
Well, and one could argue that's not really regulation, it's more incentivization.
Yeah, but ultimately, I think of this metaphor. You and I and your listeners will go to a car sometime in the next few hours probably and turn it on. Your car and my car is a point source polluter, and on that point source of pollution, there's a catalytic converter that we're required by law to have available. We weren't incented to do that by federal dollars or state dollars. We are required by law when we purchase our vehicles to purchase one through the manufacturers that have a catalytic converter. That same kind of focus on looking at individual polluters with a solution that regulates away their ability to continue to pollute at the level that they otherwise would have done is really what we need to be looking at, not just for urban and suburban and small town users of water resources. But in this state, the vast majority of attention should be on the agricultural folks who have very little regulation on how they discharge into the surface waters of this state. So point source polluters, even if they're very numerous, are addressed through clean air legislation. We need to have the same level of protection and the same enthusiasm and how we protect for the surface waters of Iowa.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me, Bill. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Greta, we very much appreciate the opportunity to talk with Iowans. Water is what connects us from the northwest part of our state to the southeast. We need to think about it as a vital resource that we all share and that we all need to protect, whether we live on farms or whether we live in cities and towns. Over-application of fertilizer, whether it's on your yard or on your farm field, ultimately is a cost that's borne by people downstream. So please be careful. Talk with your legislators and local leadership about the need to regulate for clean water.
That was Bill Stowe, head of the Des Moines Waterworks and advocate for clean water in Iowa. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Greta Anderson, your host. I'm here with Evan Berger of Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, and we're talking about water quality regulation in our state.
Yeah, I really appreciate that interview. You know, I think, you know, he lays it out so well how kind of the double standards for industrial polluters and agricultural polluters, and you know, how if we're serious about clean water, we gotta address both those sides.
You know, I kind of made that connection myself, or comparison, I suppose, when a hog confinement was being debated in Nevada recently. I'm sure you remember that,
mm-hmm.
Evan.
That's right.
This facility was going to produce two times the amount of waste that the city of Nevada itself produces. And yet there was going to be no treatment of the stuff. There was, I don't know of any kind of training required for the operator, or, you know, I know that the guy who has to spread the manure, he needs training, but I don't know about
And that's just 2 hours a year.
Just 2 hours a year, and they wanted to reduce it.
Yeah.
But the guy who's, you know, holding all that manure in his underground tank, he didn't, from what I know, require any training, and there was no permit at all for that whole process. So, you know, the fact that he might not have other good agricultural practices, which in fact he doesn't, you know, doesn't make any difference.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And that's exactly why this rulemaking is so important, because this this permitting process, what this rulemaking does is implement that Clean Water Act permitting process to make sure that a facility like that is in compliance with the Clean Water Act. And, you know, just, again, some history. I don't want to toot, you know, CCI's horn too much, but it's a fact. This work plan, this report, this rulemaking, the reason it came about was the hard work of CCI members, Sierra Club members, and Environmental Integrity Project. You know, EPA had been sitting on the sidelines for years and years and years, and it was finally with this threat of a lawsuit that they stepped in. So we're going to see this thing through to the end. We want to make sure that, you know, we don't just get the good work plan, we get the good rulemaking, and then looking down the road, we want to make sure that this rule is actually being enforced, you know. So,
well, it sounds like farmers are fairly well organized by
That's right.
the institutions that represent them, so those who regulate them probably have to be pretty well organized too.
Sure, sure.
We're about halfway through the show when we often insert a musical interlude into our mix. And I looked around for a good song, but I just kept coming back to the beautiful song by Van Morrison that has the lovely refrain, "Oh, the water." I'm sure you know it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have time for the whole thing, but we'll do a little bit of summarizing. And I want folks to really listen to the lyrics because they're kind of amazing. It starts off, this kid narrator and his buddy are, you know, Van and his friend Billy are going fishing, but it's raining hard, and their backs are against the wall. They're trying to stay dry. Then the weather changes. They hitch a ride in a pickup and decide to go for a swim in the river.
And the rain let up and the sun came up. We were getting dry. Almost glad a pickup truck nearly passed us by. So he jumped right in the driver's van, and he dropped us up the road. Yeah, we looked at the swim, and we jumped right in, not to mention fishing poles. Oh, the water. Yeah, that storm made to my soul.
I just love that line, "Let it run all over me." It seems to capture the kind of the freedom and joys of childhood. Evidently, this whole event really did happen to Van Morrison as a kid somewhere in Northern Ireland where he grew up.
Really, really.
Yeah, and he said it was a mystical moment for him. I think the mystical moment is coming up in this last verse, where he meets a guy on the side of the road. Evidently, he really was influenced by Jelly Roll Morton. So that's the Jelly Roll part. It's like, water and Jelly Roll. I'd rather have coffee.
Thank you. but our throats were getting dry. Then we saw the man from across the road with the sunshine in his eyes. But he left all alone his own little home with a great big gallon jar. There were bottles too, one for me and you, and he said, hey, there you are. Oh, the water. Get myself from the mountain stream. Yet it stung me to my soul.
So here's this guy, this old guy with a gleam in his eye, the sun in his eye, and he's got a big old gallon jar. And what does that gallon jar contain? It's not what you think. It's got pure sparkling water, and the guy got it himself from the mountain stream.
Yeah.
I love it.
It comes back to what I said, you know, we all drink water.
Yeah.
People are passionate about it.
It's 80% of our very bodies.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's stormy to myself. Stormy just like going home. And it's stormy.
That was Van Morrison, and you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've got Evan Berger in the studio with me. Evan grew up in Iowa, and now he's fighting for clean water in Iowa. So, Evan, do you have a favorite childhood memory about the waters of Iowa?
So, yeah, I grew up just outside of Ames, in between Ames and Huxley. So kind of the, you know, water, you know, body of water that we always went to play in, and, you know, that figures prominently in my early memories is Big Creek Lake, right? So, you know, I have some very early memories of going there and playing on the beach and swimming and what have you. But not so many later memories. I mean, as you know now, it's, you know, pretty highly polluted. You know, it's a kind of a case study for what happens when you just dump nitrates on the ground that empties into a body of water. It's sad, but, you know, in my later childhood, we had to go to Colorado or Wisconsin or something if we wanted to, you know, take a vacation that involved, you know, swimming or fishing or anything like that. And I think that's a common story for a lot of people. I mean, I don't know if you have something similar in your life.
Well, of course, I outdate you a bit by a few decades. And I basically learned how to swim in a natural body of water in New Hampshire. It was just clear, cold, beautiful. I remember one summer, you know, that you could see right through to the bottom of the lake, and, you know, at least 10 feet. And there were sort of beautiful granite boulders on the bottom. But there was this one little patch of sand right near our dock. And one summer, this little baby sunfish came and just decided that little patch of sand was going to be his hangout spot. And, you know, as a child, as a kid, that was just so special to me. You know, I'd go down to the dock and say hi to him every day. And here was this wild creature that had decided to, you know, take up residence with us. And it's just an image for me that I go back to, actually, of peace and contentment.
Sure.
You know, and that, but then there's sort of the flip side of that as well, because fast forward a couple decades and I'm living in Iowa City, and I've kind of decided I'm not going to be having children, but I wanted to be involved with the next generation. So I joined Big Brothers Big Sisters and got a little sister, and she was just perfect for me. She was third grade when this happened. She big, thick glasses that were always smudgy, and a couple of scrapes on her knees, kind of just like me. And we just hit it off. So I remember one day we were walking our dogs down by the Iowa River, and it was hot. The water was lazy, and I was like, let's jump in, you know, and because I, you know, I wanted to share that kind of stuff with a kid, and we did, you know, our clothes and all, and like almost immediately I had this intense remorse, like I had done something wrong, like what if the bacteria in the water got into our open cuts, and you know, like I immediately got us out, and I even remember that very same walk seeing a dead fish on the side. We made a big joke out of it because my dog kind of got halfway interested in it. But, you know, it just kind of saddens one. You cannot have those sorts of experiences in Iowa that kind of frame our childhood memories.
Yeah, it's very sad. And, you know, the big point is, you know, other states have figured out how to have agriculture and clean water. And it's just, you know, the big question is why can't we do it? So that's what we're trying to fight for.
So I suppose we should move on, as all of Iowa's water does, to the Mississippi River and the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
Sure. Yeah. So some background for folks who, you know, this hypoxic zone, kind of technical term. So nutrients, you know, are applied to land in the Midwest. They run down the Mississippi River, which, of course, empties into the Gulf of Mexico. And there, you know, these are nutrient, you know, chemicals or manure, but, you know, they're nutrients that encourage plant growth. So once they reach the water, you know, the algae down there loves it. They're gobbling this stuff up. And the bacteria that feed on the algae love, you know, this new flowering of their food source. But unfortunately, those bacteria then use up all the oxygen in the water. So it's really good for the algae and it's really good for the bacteria, but not much else can survive in terms of actual fish, you know, vertebrates or anything. That's what this hypoxic term means, is low oxygen. It's a huge problem down in the Gulf of Mexico.
It's kind of ironic. You've got nutrients that help things grow, and you've got this huge bloom fluorescence of algae, and then that just flips over and turns to all of this deadness.
It's like too much of a good thing, you know, too much of any good thing is going to turn bad. So thousands and thousands of square miles of deadness down there. Unfortunately, you know, Iowa and other Midwestern states are really kind of to blame for this. We're the ones sending this stuff downstream. So that's why, you know, Iowa has joined with 9 other states for this 10-state program called the Nutrient Reduction Strategy, trying to keep nutrients out of the water so that this doesn't keep happening. So the timeline on this is, you know, that the Iowa legislature passed this law that implemented the Nutrient Reduction Strategy in 2013, last year. And, you know, it was a compromise bill. It was better than nothing, but really, the big problem with it is everything was voluntary. There are no requirements for farmers or the people who are applying these nutrients. And so this idea of voluntary compliance is kind of the driving principle behind this entire strategy. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. It's kind of, you know, the analogy I like to use is, or CCI members like to use is, you know, if we had a voluntary speed limit, for instance, if we had voluntary compliance in the realm of traffic laws, that's the same thing as having no speed limit whatsoever. So what we see is they're really not the Iowa legislature is really not serious about nutrient reduction just yet.
So this brings us to the point of the paper that I mentioned at the beginning of the show. David Osterberg, a public researcher for Iowa Policy Project, paper is entitled "A Threat Unmet: Why Iowa's Nutrient Reduction Strategy Falls Short." It was published yesterday, and we have David on the line.
You do.
Oh, great. And David, we've talked about a lot in the show already. We've talked about the history between the EPA and the Iowa DNR, about the upcoming rulemaking by the EPC on point source permits. We talked with Bill Stowe about his issues at the Des Moines Waterworks. And in fact, I asked him about the historical data. You know, do you have any historical data? And then lo and behold, I open up your paper and I see.
Right, there is. Exactly.
There is, exactly.
It's a good data set. It's 40 years long, and it shows the nitrates go up over that 40-year period. So this is not something that's new. It's not something that's going to, you know, it'll go away if we just hope it'll go away.
So can you tell us about the main impetus of your paper? What did you set out to discover?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, this paper is meant to be a pro-nutrient reduction strategy. I'd like to see it work, but it can't work unless we make some changes in it. And so after introducing the topic, by the way, you can just go to www.iowapolicyproject.org and get a copy. And what you'll find is about 12 pages of the background, and then on page 13, sort of get at it. It's like 20 pages. But there are things that are good about this nutrient reduction strategy. You keep hearing the Secretary of Agriculture talk about this is voluntary, but it's voluntary on steroids, which sounds good, but it doesn't mean anything. What it says is that many groups out there are now attuned to this, and they're going to be making some changes. There's been a little bit of new money, and when that new money went out, a lot of farmers really gobbled it up. They keep talking about the fact that within, you know, days, over $2 million went out to people who wanted to try cover crops. They made sure that those were in just about every county in Iowa, and they covered maybe 100,000 acres, which would be good if we didn't have 23 million acres that we needed to cover. That's a big step from initial interest to making sure that everybody participates. And that's one of the problems. There are a lot of wonderful farmers who do all sorts of conservation programs. Sometimes they get it with cost share. Sometimes they do it on their own. But just like not all of my neighbors are great people, not all farmers are real conservationists. And we have data from a very good polling that's done every year from Iowa State University. It used to be done by Paul Lasley, now a guy named Arbuckle does it. Where in 2011, they just asked what farmers were doing. More than 50% said they were doing absolutely nothing for conservation.
More than 50%.
That's right. It was 51%. You can go to Iowa State University and find the Rural Life poll. And again, it comes out yearly. It's very good. Lots of rural people and farmers participate. They get a real good return back, and it's very well respected. And 51%, nothing. And if you say less than $5,000 in the last 10 years, and you find that 73%. Spent less than $5,000 over 10 years on their land for conservation. And it was a very wide definition. And they said, make sure now you count your time, you count everything you can think of. Tell me now how much conservation you've done. Still, 51% said none. Now, that says to me that not every farmer is a great farmer. And therefore, you need to have some programs that are going to have to get after everybody. And so one of the probably the most controversial things, I said that we should have, this can be a voluntary program, but you got to pick two. You can voluntarily pick two practices on your land that are going to help the dead zone and are going to help water quality in Iowa. And what I suggest, you go to the Iowa Soybean Association and look at the list of things they're recommending their farmers do. Take any two of those. And that would move us towards people actually participating. So you can really say we are doing this on steroids and all farmers are participating. The other thing we say, of course, is you got to have some more money. Terry Branstad, much to the chagrin of the Secretary of Agriculture, vetoed more than $11 million of money that could have gone into this program. He just flat-out vetoed it after the Iowa legislature and an appropriation bill had said, we're going to spend some more money on this issue. Branstad vetoes a big portion of it. I quote the Secretary. I mean, all of this stuff, it's very nice to do a program like this because when I quote the Secretary, I quote him saying, look, Governor, if you veto this, it's sure going to give ammunition to opponents of the nutrient reduction strategy. It sure does. He vetoed it.
So, David, just to clarify, this funding was, like you said, Secretary Northey, you know, was in favor of it. This appropriations bill also went through both houses of the Iowa legislature, correct?
Had to, yes.
Before
it gets to the governor's desk, it had to be passed by a Democratically-controlled House and a Republican-controlled House. Went to the governor, he vetoed it. So you can't make this work without money. And we think you can't make it work without having everybody participate in some way. That's why two practices, and a practice would be something like cover crops or buffers along streams or wetlands or a number of very good programs that, again, the Iowa Soybean Association has been quite forthcoming on trying to work with their members to show them how they can reduce their nutrients going into rivers and streams in Iowa.
Yeah, you know, I've I have heard the Iowa Soybean Association radio ad about clean water, and I was very skeptical at first. And then I heard you speak on this, and then I read around, and in fact, this is the first of a couple of shows I'm going to be doing on water. And next week, we will be interviewing the Iowa Soybean Association and some farmers who have worked with it. So, you know, there are some good stories out there, but like you say, I can drive right around my rural neighborhood and see that by no means are all the farmers doing the right thing.
Yeah, and when it comes to something like water quality, you can get a lot of people in, you know, some stream segment, all of whom are voluntarily, maybe, acting and reducing their emissions into those streams. But you have one guy who just decides he's not going to participate because he don't have to. Nobody's telling him what to do. He can ruin it for everybody. And you're not going to get to those people with a voluntary program.
By quoting that imaginary farmer, you kind of get at maybe some cultural issues that might be involved.
Well, again, you can go to the Rural Life poll if you want. And this was, I think, from a 2008 where the question was, what do you think about people telling you what to do on your own land? And people were just saying, nobody tell me nothing. And a very large number of people said, these are property rights. I am the only person who gets to say anything about my land. When you find those kind of, you just find lots of different people. And that's why I said, I got a neighbor who likes to burn stuff, even though we have a burn ban in Mount Vernon, Iowa. He's not going to stop doing that because he just wants to do it. And it doesn't matter. We find all kinds of people, different people have different behaviors. And we shouldn't expect all farmers to be conservationists, just like we don't expect all my neighbors to be environmentalists. That's why you have to have regulations. You can't depend on everybody being reasonable. But we've said, okay, go ahead. Make it voluntary, but you have to choose two things you're going to do out of this list. It's voluntary in the sense that the Soybean Association has come up with six or eight things you could do. Pick two. Just pick two.
So a mandatory choice of...
I guess so. A mandatory voluntary measure here. Yeah. When most people would think about that, they'd say, yeah. Buffer strips along streams, which I happen to think are the best thing you can do. Really, really good phosphorus reduction, especially. And it depends on tiling, whether or not it's real good on nitrogen. Boy, that would be my pick, but I'm not saying that my pick happens. That would be mandatory. You can pick that one if you like, or you can pick cover crops and do a bioreactor and do other things. But you got to participate. You got to be in the program. And right now, when 51% of farmers said they were doing absolutely nothing, and a poll that was as recent as 2011, you can't just say voluntary is going to work.
Well, David, your paper is very thorough. It's a really good primer for anyone who's interested in this issue. You've brought together a lot of data that really lays out the problem, and you're presenting a solution as well.
Yes, and a lot of the thing you will find come papers from Iowa State University professors. I have a master's degree in agricultural economics from the University of Wisconsin. I don't imagine many farmers are going to take my advice, but they sure ought to take the advice from Matt Helmers, who we quote just all kinds of people who have done pretty good papers on this. And not everybody is talking about this voluntary, non-voluntary thing, but they are doing a very good job of showing what practices seem to work. And oftentimes, if you're going to really make it work, there's got to be either a threat that the EPA is going to come in and do something. That's another thing. You have to make that threat real, and the way you do that is you set up a timeline and say, if we're not there, then it's going to get. Then we're going to have to move to mandatory. That's another one of the changes that need to happen. We have to start saying, when is this going to be accomplished? When are we going to get to 45% reduction? Because right now, if you ask the question, well, when is this supposed to happen, there is no timeline. So 100 years, 1,000 years, I don't know. We're going to accomplish this sometime. We're going to get this thing going on steroids, but there is no time when this is supposed to be accomplished. How can you have a strategy that has no timeline?
I think it's a great question, David, and I just have a question for you. I think I know the answer. So how do you, you know, if we want to implement this PIC2 idea or implement a timeline, include those into the nutrient reduction strategy, how does that?
And it would come to the Water Resources Coordinating Council, which is a group that's supposed to make these decisions. They would simply say, okay, this is the modification we're doing, and the modification says these six things, if people adopted all six of them.
Those are two policy guys talking to each other.
That's right. No, and it is, Greta, it is a nice paper. It was good to work on. I learned a lot. I read the sociology, rural sociology literature that, as I said, I'm an economist, and I had not really read, where you find out what works, what kind of incentives. And a lot of farmers do things not because they get cost share, but simply because it's the right thing to do, simply because they want to show their neighbors and the people around them that they are participating, they're part of the society, and there's a bunch of material on that and how you can bring out those behaviors in people. Hmm. But you still have to figure out, how are you going to deal with those people who are recalcitrant, who just don't think it's their job? And in fact, I have another Iowa State survey, which actually showed that a number of farmers around Black Hawk Lake near Carroll, a huge number, 25% to 30%, said they didn't know if their farm practices were having an effect on the local lake. And then about 10% denied they had any responsibility whatsoever. They said in the survey, my stuff on my land has nothing to do with the pollution in that lake. Well, I'm afraid they're wrong, but if that's what their belief is, it's going to be hard to get them voluntarily to act.
Well, we're going to have to end with that. David, thank you so much.
Hey, Greta, great to talk. Good to talk to you, Evan.
Yeah, bye now.
That was David Osterberg of Iowa Policy Project discussing his recent paper, A Threat Unmet, Why Iowa's Nutrient Reduction Strategy Falls Short. It was published yesterday, and it's very easy to access on the web. We'll have a link to it. We're running out of time. Evan, can you remind us what is the Clean Water Campaign that Iowa CCI is conducting?
Sure, yeah. So just in the one-minute version is we're trying to enforce the Clean Water Act here in Iowa, and for that to happen, we need a strong Clean Water Act rule. So if you care about water, you know, and while you're visiting the Policy Project's website, also visit www.cleanwaterfight.org, and you can sign the Clean Water Pledge online there.
And, of course, there will be the November elections. I'm sure you're going to play a part.
That's very true.
We've got a clip that can entertain us for 20 seconds.
Another area that we need to look at is the Environmental Protection Agency. When we talk about the rules and regulations that are burdening business owners, whether it's in ag, whether it's in industry here in the state of Iowa, let's shut down the federal EPA and focus on those issues here in the state.
That was Joni Ernst running for Senate in Iowa. So thank you very much, Evan,
sure,
for being here with us today. And we heard from David Osterberg, as I said, Bill Stowe, director of Des Moines Public Works. Thank you to Rick Morrison and Becca Brown, our engineers. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. Tune in next Friday. I'll have another in the series on water issues in the state. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their album, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also received spiritual guidance from George Ivan Morrison of Belfast, Ireland. As always, your participation as a listener is what makes this show possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.